Hej och välkomna till A Flatpack History of Sweden. That's hello and welcome to A Flatpack History of Sweden in Swedish, if you couldn't guess. And we're the podcast that for 100 regular episodes has journeyed through Swedish history, one period or event at a time. My name is Chris, as always, and sitting across from me through all of those hours of podcast recordings that we've amassed together is my co-host, Åsa.
Yes, hello, and welcome to our special episode celebrating the fact that A Flatpack History of Sweden has now released 100 regular episodes, plus 10 special episodes, or rather this is the 10th, and then we did 2 Tangent Time episodes so far. It's an often used metaphor, but it has been a journey from our kitchen table in London to our kitchen table in Stockholm, I guess.
Via a sofa in another flat in Stockholm.
True, that was also a place where we recorded, and through thousands of years of history as well.
So yeah, we just thought that we would get rolling with this special episode to celebrate the fact we made it this far.
Yeah, a while ago, as we were approaching the 100th episode, we asked all of you, our lovely listeners, to write to us and let you know what you thought our special anniversary episode should be about. And we got a lot of great suggestions.
Yeah, we really did. And they've all been noted down. And it's quite likely that some of them, if not all of them, will become special episodes at some point in the podcast. So thank you to everyone who sent in some really great suggestions that we wish we had time to do them all. But I'm sure we'll get around to them at some point. And in the end, we've picked a great suggestion from Liam, who wanted us to talk about not kind of one event, but a bit of a time when three major things all happened at once in Swedish history that he heard about from someone at work once. So yes, this episode will be dedicated to three incredibly intense weeks in Sweden in 1973, when history just seemed to cram everything into a very short period of time. So what we'll do is we'll look at those three events and imagine the roller coaster that Sweden must have been on between the 23rd of August and the 16th of September in 1973. But as always, we need to do our Swedish phrase of the week.
And the anniversary phrase is binda ris åt egen rygg, which translates to English as bind brushwood for your own back.
Or bind rice for your own back, but that's not what it means in this context. Now, this phrase definitely requires a little bit of an explanation because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense on first reading.
No, it doesn't. First of all, ris, which in this case translates to brushwood, was what people used to use when they wanted to spank, I suppose, especially children, like how in some cultures you might have used a wooden spoon or a shoe. And perhaps you still do. So ris, brushwood, was what you used to spank children or adults, or I guess anyone you wanted to punish. And you usually hit them on the back or the backside.
Yeah, and it's like twigs, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, more or less. So bind brushwood for your own back means to create the means for which to punish yourself. Or simply put, that you yourself create something that then backfires and affects you negatively. Say you suggest you can help plan a friend's wedding because you think it's fun to plan events and parties, but then it ends up being so much work that you're stressed and tired the whole time. Then you can say, well, I volunteered to do it because I thought it'd be fun, but I should have known how stressful it would become. In the end, I'm just binder ris åt egen rygg. I'm just binding brushwood for my own back.
And the binding is the point that you need lots of twigs into one big block because just one twig isn't going to do anything.
No. So you bind the brushwood and then you're going to be hit with it. And in this case, you've done it to yourself.
In English, you'd probably say make a rod for your own back, which means exactly the same as this, or maybe the creator of your own downfall. But that's a bit, it's not really a phrase. That's just a thing you could say.
Yeah, and I love how this phrase, the Swedish phrase, could also include the rice option if you didn't know the real meaning. Because like Chris said earlier, the word ris in Swedish could be both rice, as in the food item, and a bunch of twigs, brushwood, or a collection of twigs.
But now let's head back in time and set the scene for where we're at in 1973, because it's quite far ahead from where we are in our regular chronological episodes, where we've only got up to 1523.
Exactly, we're jumping 450 years ahead in our timeline now. By 1973, Sweden has stopped having constant wars with Denmark or Russia, we've lost Finland, we've industrialized and moved from an almost entirely rural population to a mainly urban population. We've transitioned into democracy and created a welfare state.
But still eating herring and rye bread and drinking beer.
Yeah, some things never change.
In fact, when 1973 rolls around, Sweden is just starting to come off what is known as rekordåren, the record years. And it was a period from the end of the Second World War to the early 1970s when Sweden experienced an economic and financial boom, which led to a dramatic increase in living standards and near full employment for the entire population.
Not just a full employment rate, in fact, but also a shortage of labour, which led to Sweden actively seeking labour immigration to the country. Thousands of people from Finland, Greece, Italy, what was then Yugoslavia, and people from other European countries came to work in Sweden, bringing with them cultural changes as Sweden slowly became a more multicultural country.
And they worked in Swedish industry that was pumping out everything from Volvo cars and SKF ball bearings to textiles, medicines, and even fighter jets. But this was also a time of incredible tension between the East and the West, as everybody knows. The Cold War was, still going on, and Sweden maintained a policy of non-alignment, not joining NATO like Denmark and Norway had done at the start of that organisation, but instead maintaining its own independent armed forces based on a conscription army and, considering the size of the country, a very large air force, all of which was produced at home in Sweden, which was a very unique capability for a country of its size, and it's actually something it still does today.
Another thing that's worth keeping in mind when we get to 1973 is that Sweden has by then had a social democratic government since 1936. So that's 37 years with the same political party in power.
And that's really unusual, considering Sweden was actually a democracy. So it wasn't like they were holding power by force or through a military dictatorship or something like that. There were free and fair elections with a free press and a neutral public broadcaster.
Yeah, it was just a case that every 3 years the country would go and vote and the Swedes would keep returning the same party to power, as things in general were going pretty well for the country. No reason to change, I suppose. In fact, for 23 of those 37 years, the Swedes didn't just return the same party to power, they returned the same prime minister. So Tage Erlander was prime minister from 1946 to 1969, which I tried to look up if that was the record for a democratically elected prime minister or president. I couldn't find a conclusive answer, but it must be up there.
What about Kekkonen in Finland?
Yeah, he was also president for a very long time. I think he might outdo Erlander.
But he wasn't the prime minister.
Exactly.
Let's take a brief look at stuff that's going on outside of Sweden for people like us who weren't born in 1973. It's good to pop back and have a little look about what things were like then. And 1973 is remembered for things like the end of the Vietnam War, with the Paris Peace Accords being signed in January of that year. The world is currently plagued by high fuel prices and energy shortages brought about by an oil crisis, which is in turn brought on because of the outbreak of war between Israel and several of its neighbouring countries, what's often called the Yom Kippur War. Back in my home country of the UK, the IRA have started a series of bombings on the British mainland, which will continue over the next couple of years and, well, decades really, as part of the civil conflict in Northern Ireland that's referred to as the Troubles.
In Chile, the democratically elected president Salvador Allende is killed in a bloody military coup this year, and terrible atrocities against the population are committed. And here, there's a slight connection to Sweden, because the SVT news photographer, Leonard Henriksson, so SVT is the Swedish public broadcaster, like the BBC in Britain, well, he is shot by a Chilean soldier whilst he's filming a news broadcast from Santiago.
We actually watched this quite recently because it was shown on TV last year due to the 50th anniversary. And in the footage, you actually see the soldier aiming and firing at the camera that then moves and judders as the cameraman collapses and dies. And you hear his reporter colleague shouting his name over the sounds of the drama. Really crazy event.
It is, and it's a vivid reminder of the danger journalists sometimes find themselves in. Another impact that the Chilean coup has on Sweden is that over 8,000 Chileans get political asylum here after fleeing the coup, and many of them come to Malmö, close to where I grew up.
Otherwise, people might remember 1973 as the year that Pink Floyd released Dark Side of the Moon, or Sunderland won the FA Cup 1-0 against Leeds, who were the holders at the time. But back to Sweden and the first of our three events that will set those 3 weeks in August and September apart as unusually intense and eventful. So we begin on Thursday the 23rd of August with a beautiful late summer's day in Stockholm. It's just past 10 o'clock in the morning and we're in the office of the Kreditbanken Bank at Norrmalmstorg in the city centre, a 3 to 5 minute walk from the Parliament and the Royal Palace. And the bank is quite busy, not crazy busy, but definitely not empty, because of course this is 1973 and it's a time when people had a lot more things to do and needed to go to an actual bank to get them done. And all of a sudden, the normal talking and general hubbub of the customers and staff is broken when a man fires a round from an AK-4 rifle up into the ceiling and shouts, "Everybody get down, the party starts."
And he actually shouts this in English, which is a bit strange, but he is a rather strange-looking guy. He's wearing a sort of curly-haired wig and has covered his face in dark foundation cream. He then throws a bag onto the cashier's table, and of course by now everybody has realized that this is a robbery.
So the staff hide under their counters and some manage to make their way into the bank's vault. The customers either manage to make their way out or hide in the main bank hall. But one of the bank clerks manages to trigger an alarm to the police. And because this is in central Stockholm, right in the middle of everything, the first police car actually arrives very quickly. And two policemen, just on their own, enter the bank to confront the robber.
Now, this might seem very strange to us listening today. And indeed, this was something that the Swedish TV programme Kriminalarkivet, the Crime Archives, went through in detail when they covered this case. It seems like, at the time, it was standard practice in the Swedish police for the first police officers on site to also be the first to act. There was no waiting around for backup or calling in like a special force team or something. And unlike in, say, the UK, these ordinary police officers are armed, so they're carrying their regular pistols when they go in to confront this armed robber.
But the Stockholm police will soon realise that this isn't an ordinary bank robber, because the first officer that steps into the bank is immediately shot by the robber. Thankfully only in the hand, but still, armed robbery in broad daylight isn't a common occurrence in 1970s Stockholm, let alone one that actually uses his weapon and fires on police. So the two police officers quickly make a retreat and leave the building, quite wisely.
Another thing that makes it clear that this is no ordinary bank robbery is that he doesn't just grab the money and get out, but rather he barricades himself in the bank, taking three women bank clerks hostage.
As if armed robbery wasn't bad enough, this is now a hostage situation. Actually, the robber will end up holding four people hostage, the first three women, and then a man who is found hiding in somewhere else in the bank later on by the robber.
After a while, everyone except the hostage and the robber managed to leave the bank and get to the square outside, which instead now fills with equal numbers of policemen and reporters. Because as it becomes clear that this isn't going to be over in a jiffy, Swedish TV starts reporting this pretty much live, with cameras and reporters around the square. Again, it's right in the city center of Stockholm, so TV and newspapers can send as many people as they want there in no time at all.
That is all the journalists they haven't sent to report live from Helsingborg in southern Sweden, because that's where King Gustav VI Adolf has been in hospital since the 18th of August, so for the last 5 days now. And the king is 90 years old, and although he's been in good health, even taking a trip over to Denmark just a few days before he went into hospital, it does seem like there's something serious going on. His daughter, Queen Ingrid of Denmark, has come over, and soon the Crown Prince of Sweden and heir to the throne, Carl Gustaf, is joining the family in Helsingborg too.
Yeah, that can't be a good sign. So there are reporters in Helsingborg, and there's now reporters on the square in Stockholm. Because in Stockholm, it's not a good sign when, not long after the hostage-taking begins, the robber is coming forward with his demands to release them. So he wants 3 million Swedish kronor in 2 bags, a Ford Mustang sports car to flee in, and this is the kicker, he wants Clark Olofsson released from prison. 3 million in 1973 money is about 25 million Swedish kronor in today's money, by the way. So that's 2.3 million US dollars or 1.9 million pounds. So yeah, the money is a big deal.
But whilst this is a lot of money, it's the last demand that seems to make everyone choke on their coffee a bit. Because Clark Olofsson is a career criminal, notorious for his string of violent crimes and many prison breaks. Actually, he once broke into the Prime Minister that we mentioned previously, Tage Erlander. They broke into his summer house once.
Yeah, and drank his brandy, I think.
Yeah.
This guy, yeah, is violent crime personified. There's a quite entertaining Netflix series about him that came out recently. Some have accused it of making light of his many crimes, but I thought it was quite good. In it, Clark Olofsson is played by Bill Skarsgård, who is perhaps most famous for playing the scary clown Pennywise in It.
And it's just called Clark, if you want to watch it.
Yeah.
As time goes on, there's no real resolution to this hostage situation, though. So the police actually decide to meet the robber's demands and get Clark Olofsson out of Norrköping prison, where he's held a couple of hours away from Stockholm, and get him to the bank later that same afternoon. So it happens really quickly. And he's given instructions, you know, hardened criminal instructions, to try and negotiate with the robber. But it obviously doesn't go very well.
No, in fact, nothing goes too well. As it happens, for the first 2 days, the police even get the identity of the robber wrong.
Yeah, this is mad. Because already from the first day, both the police and reporters are able to actually ring the bank. Because, yeah, there's a phone in there. And lo and behold, the robber is actually answering when people call. So that becomes an easy line of communication into the bank. And it's clear pretty much from the start that even though he tried to speak English at the start of the robbery with his slightly weird "get down on the floor, the party starts," the robber is Swedish, and just like also, he's from Skåne.
And like me, he speaks with a thick Skånsk accent. I hope that's where our similarities end, but we both have this thick accent. And that led the police to think that the robber was a man called Kai Hansson. When some radio news reporters get wind of this, they get hold of Kai Hansson's mother, who makes a tearful speech on radio urging her son to give up. Because at this point, it's also become clear to both the police and the media that the robber brought a radio with him into the bank so he can listen to all the reporting that's going on outside. And that adds extra dimension to this situation, the fact that the robber and Olofsson and the hostages can listen to the live reporting going on outside. That and the fact that, like Chris said, there's a phone line into the bank. This means that it's not just the journalists reporting that you hear. They also get the robber, Clark Olofsson, and even the hostages to speak live on radio and TV that goes straight into the homes of millions of Swedes.
Yeah, and this is no doubt why so many Swedes who were alive then still remember this day very vividly, like it was happening yesterday, because this was one of those true events where almost everyone felt like they were part of it, watching it unfold.
On the evening of the first day, one of the hostages even speaks to then Prime Minister Olof Palme. During the call, she is urging the Prime Minister to make the police yield to the robbers' demands and even offers that her and another hostage will flee with the robber and Olofsson just to put an end to the situation. The Prime Minister makes a few ill-advised comments during the call, including mumbling something about dying on your post and not giving in to criminals, which sounds unbelievable when you mention it nowadays. And yeah, he was very heavily criticized for that.
So he just said they should just stay there and die when the police take back the bank or something? Or?
Yeah, well, he is urging her to not give in to the criminals, because that's what she is suggesting to do. Basically just saying, let them do whatever they want. Like, we will even go with them.
What's the dying on your post bit?
That they should resist and not give in to their demands. Yeah, it's all a bit weird. Yeah, in hindsight, it's easy to see how the hostages essentially would have done anything to try and stay alive and put an end to the horrible situation they're in.
Indeed, and I think today we have some much more psychological research and a better understanding of how the human mind works in situations like this. But at the time, many viewed the fact that the hostages seemed to be sympathizing with the hostage takers as being incredibly strange. And it gave rise to a phrase we've actually talked about on the podcast before, being a Swedish phrase of the week, which was Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, that was our Swedish phrase of the week back in episode 33.
Stockholm Syndrome was coined by Swedish psychiatrist Niels Bejerot to describe the condition where a kidnapped victim begins to sympathise with the kidnapper and turn against the police or the authorities. Although in Swedish it's not called Stockholm Syndrome, though.
No, we call it Norrmalmstorgssyndromet, named after the exact square where this robbery stroke hostage taking took place.
But did Niels Bejerot call it Stockholm Syndrome? Or did he call it Norrmalmstorgssyndrome? Or did he call it both?
Called it both. When he started publishing about it in English, it became too, like, niche to call it after the square, so they called it after the city instead.
But it was he did that?
As far as I know, yes.
Yeah, so this event has given something more to history than just a bit of drama. It's given a name to a psychological condition. And during the second day of the hostage taking, so this is now Friday the 24th of August, the police get a hold of Kai Hansson's brother and ask him to go in and talk to his brother, because if there's an armed robber who's already shot at the police, surely it's going to be safer for his brother to go in, because he's probably not going to shoot his own brother.
You can really see how the Swedish police is not used to handling these types of situation. And, well, yeah, the hostage taking is dragging on now. It's been over a day. So, yeah, Kai Hansson's brother goes in, and guess what happens?
Well, the robber panics and shoots at him twice, but luckily doesn't hit him, because guess what? This isn't his brother taking the hostages. The guy runs back out to the police screaming, "Get a grip, you've got the wrong guy," which is probably how I'd react to.
Yeah, because it's not Kai Hansson in the bank. For 2 days they had the wrong identity of the robber, because it's another criminal who also happened to be from Skåne and have a thick Skånsk accent. His name is Janne Olsson, and he's been in prison with Clark Olofsson, and maybe it was in order to impress the more senior Olofsson that he was going to try and use the robbery and the hostage taking to now get his friend out of prison.
Meanwhile, all of this is, of course, torture for the hostages. They've now seen the robber shoot two people, and they're in there with two career criminals who, although it seems like they're being quite nice to the hostages, they are still armed, and for certain periods, they're also keeping the hostages tied up. Plus, the police are doing pretty much a useless job outside, failing to get anything done.
Over the next couple of days, so this is really dragging on, the police make several failed attempts to enter the bank, including, yes, sending more policemen into the bank, which again results in the robber firing more shots at them, although again, luckily none of them are hit. But then the police also begin to drill a hole in the ceiling down into the bank vault where Olofsson and Olsson have barricaded themselves with the hostages. Olsson and Olofsson place explosives that Olsson apparently brought with him into the bank. They place that around the hole that the police is drilling. And so when the drill breaks through, they explode it, breaking the drill and knocking the electricity out. All of this yields little result other than frightening the hostages even further.
Yeah, this is insane. They're using explosives to blow up the drill. And nonetheless, the Norman's Toy drama, the drama at Norman's Toy as it becomes known, will end soon, though. Because the police decide to make another attempt at drilling a hole into the bank vault. They've gone and bought a new drill from around the corner, wherever they got the first one from. And this time, their plan actually succeeds. And so at 9:28 on the 28th of August, so more than 5 days after the whole siege began, they release tear gas through the hole into the vault, which forces the criminals to give up.
And no doubt is just the icing of a terribly frightening and horrible experience for the hostages.
While some of them chose to give interviews shortly after the event, all four of them chose to continue their lives afterwards in peace and anonymity, a fact that always seems to have been respected by both the Swedish media and public. They're not turning up for anniversaries or anything like this and talking about it in the newspapers. The two criminals, though, don't shy away from the limelight. Janne Olsson has always been very forthcoming with his version of the events, and you can find several interviews with him, including one they did for the 50th anniversary. And whilst Clark Olofsson isn't turning up in 50th anniversary videos and giving interviews, he continues a life of crime, and a violent life of crime too, with some more spectacular crimes and prison breaks to come.
There are several books, documentaries, and even movies and TV series about the drama at Norrmalms Torg. The one I personally recommend is a TV movie called Norrmalms Torg from 2003, although it takes some artistic license and isn't exactly faithful to how all the details unfolded, I think it's a thrilling account of the event overall.
It might surprise some listeners, but the two criminals didn't actually get that long prison sentences as punishment for their roles in the robbery and hostage-taking. Olsson was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and Olofsson was actually acquitted by the Swedish Court of Appeal on the argument that he didn't start or assist the robbery or the hostage-taking. But either way, Olofsson would go on to commit so many other crimes that he spent more than half of his life in prison or juvenile facilities.
True, and 10 years in prison was actually a severe sentence for the time. In the 70s, Sweden had a much more, let's call it, liberal attitude to prison sentences, with shorter stays in prison than we do today, even if today's Swedish justice system tends to give shorter sentences than in some other countries, especially when we compare it to, say, the US.
Indeed, but what about the king? I guess he's following this live on TV and the newspapers and stuff too?
Well, probably not, because he's not doing very well. He's seemingly not making any recovery from the bleeding ulcers that were the cause of his hospitalization back on the 18th of August. He's still in hospital as the siege ends, and for the first few weeks of September, yeah, he's still just in hospital, not doing very well.
Meanwhile, during the first weeks of September, the country is also entering into the final days of the general election campaign, an election that's due to be held on the 16th of September. And like we said earlier, the Social Democratic Party has been in government since 1936, and since 1969, they've been led by the charismatic nobleman termed socialist Olof Palme. As we've seen in the regular episodes, the nobility in Sweden has always been very important and has played their part in the political events of Swedish history. And this is still very much the case in the 1970s too, and there is definitely still a sense of the nobility being around, even today in 2024 at the time of recording. Listeners would recognise certain surnames today that were around in the 14 or 1500s, and there's even the House of the Nobility in Sweden, which only allows the nobility to be members and have their weddings and join this society. And it's a really, well, it's more than a society, it's sort of a historical club for these noble families. And some noble families in Sweden even have exemptions from certain inheritance and tax rules. So while Sweden is a very liberal country in many ways, the nobility are still a very prominent section of society in ways that many people moving here or knowing stuff about Sweden are very surprised about.
Now, you said that Olof Palme was a charismatic nobleman turned socialist. He himself was always very keen to style himself a democratic socialist, so leader of the Social Democratic Party. This is to distinguish himself from the more left-wing elements sweeping through not just Sweden, but European politics in the late 60s and early 70s. So yeah, he's a democratic socialist. He's certainly not a communist.
And in addition to the Social Democrats, there are four other parties in parliament at this time, all fighting this election. One of them are the real communists, the Communist Party, or to use their full name, Vänsterpartiet Kommunisterna, the left party, the communists. Despite these also being on the left side of the political spectrum, they're not part of Olof Palme's government and they don't have any ministers in the cabinet. They of course sometimes support the government against the political parties on the right, but Olof Palme has his own majority government and doesn't need the communists' support to pass any legislation. Then on the right, we have the moderates, a bit like the British Conservative Party, centre-right, certainly more to the left than the American Republican Party, though. And we have the liberals, too. At the time, they were called Folkpartiet, the People's Party in English. And then we have the Centre Party, who were originally a farmers' party called the Farmers' Party. And they're also on the right of centre, but like their name suggests, pretty close to the centre ground of politics.
And then there are a number of more fringe parties who fail to get the required 4% of the total voting share to gain a seat in parliament.
Yeah, because you need to get 4% in the general election to actually get MPs. So if you got 3.99%, you wouldn't get any seats. Whereas if you just got 4%, you would get maybe up to like 10 or so MPs. There's this cutoff that you need to reach before you're allowed to have seats in parliament.
Of those more fringe parties, most notably on the right, there are the Christian Democrat Party, so a socially conservative party with their voter base strongly among the Swedish Pentecostal movement at this time. Today, the Christian Democrats are actually a party in parliament. They got over that 4% threshold, and they make up part of the current coalition government since 2022, and their voter base has broadened significantly. Although at the moment, yeah, they're in danger of falling under those 4% and out of parliament again come next election. On the left, we have a number of left-wing fringe parties in the 70s, including some quite extreme communist parties like KPMLR, KPMLR, short for the Communist Party Marxist-Leninists. And then they added the R for revolutionary when they split from the original Communist Party Marxist-Leninists. The left-wing political fringe in the 1970s is incredibly confusing.
It's like from The Life of Brian, you know, we're the Popular People's Front of Judea. It's like, well, we're the People's Popular Front of Judea.
You're closer to the truth than you'd think.
Nonetheless, these fringe parties failed to gain any real power because they were struggling to get into parliament most of the time. And to the extent they had any real strong support, this was coming from Gothenburg, which led people to talk about the Red West of Sweden, with Gothenburg being the city on the west coast. But actually, they're probably mainly remembered today, the left-wing fringe parties, for that impact they had on the Swedish music scene, with folk bands and traditional Swedish visa singers, the folk songs, seeing a revival as those genres that then became a vehicle for political pop cultural expression. So there were a lot of communists singing these folk songs.
Yeah, so whilst ABBA was winning Eurovision, we also had a lot of these left-wing folk singers in Sweden. We've arrived at the 15th of September, and it's now the evening before the election. Prime Minister Olof Palme is giving his final speech to a large crowd in Gothenburg, rallying them up to go and vote and keep him in power. Covering the election and Olof Palme's speech is a young reporter from SVT's main evening news program Aktuellt, and he's called Hans Dahlgren. Hans Dahlgren was actually a reporter from the Norrmalmstorg bank robbery just a few days earlier, so he's having quite a year. And just a small side note, he will much later in history become an MP and government minister.
For the Social Democrats.
Yes, but back in 1973, whilst the Prime Minister is speaking, Hans gets a phone call. Not clearly exactly how, because they didn't have mobile phones at the time, but anyhow, he gets a call from his reporter friend, who's down in Helsingborg, waiting to report on the king, who's still in hospital.
And basically, his friend tells Hans, listen, it's not looking good here. I think they might announce that the king has died any time now. And so with that quite significant heads up in mind, Hans Dahlgren makes his way through the crowd up to the Prime Minister and his aide and whispers to them something along the lines of, Prime Minister, I've got a tip from my colleague down in Helsingborg. We should probably get you to a TV studio because you might have to address the nation about the death of the king very soon.
Yeah, except he wouldn't have called him Prime Minister. By 1973, we had stopped using titles in Sweden. He would have just called him Olof, which you find extremely strange, don't you, that we call the Prime Minister by their first name.
It's ridiculous. I think it's really weird. Same as like in America, you wouldn't just go up to someone and say, oh, hi, Joe. Hi, Donald. It would be Mr. President. And we say that in the UK, you know, Mr. Prime Minister, Secretary of State, Minister. Yeah, but in Sweden, it's, oh, sup, Björn.
Yeah, if the current Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, if I met him, it'd be incredibly weird if I called him Statsminister, Prime Minister. He's just Ulf.
No, it's weird. It's weird, very weird. The only person who has a title, well, is maybe Talmannen, the Speaker of the House. That's a half a step up in formality.
Yeah, I'd still just call him by his first name.
Yeah, or and the King, though.
I'd call him Your Majesty. But yeah, it's a first name for everyone else in the country.
Mm. Hans Dahlgren giving the Prime Minister that heads up proved to be a very good thing, because almost straight away afterwards, the Riksmarschalk, the most senior civil servant in charge of the royal household, steps out of the entrance to Helsingborg Hospital and announces, King Gustav VI Adolf has today, Saturday the 15th of September 1973, at 8:35, quietly and peacefully died.
And that is the literal quote. That is all. One sentence on the steps of a hospital entrance. There's no pomp, no circumstance. It's very somber, very to the point. You could argue it's very Swedish.
After delivering that brief and to-the-point message, he stands aside and 27-year-old Carl Gustaf, now King Carl the 16th Gustaf, walks out accompanied by his aunt Queen Ingrid of Denmark on one side and his youngest sister Princess Christina on the other. And there's just a whole group of people just standing around half a metre away from the king. There's no security or anything like this. He just walks out of this hospital and he's walking away towards what is presumably a car on the other side. And then one person just shouts, long live the king, and then everyone in the crowd goes, hurrah, 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 and then he gives like a brief nod and then just continues walking. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, Well, with that, Sweden has lost a king and gained a new one. Definitely compared to how it works in the UK. This is very, what's the opposite to extravagant?
Plain.
Yeah, maybe very plain, very lagom, very Swedish. And it's a well-liked king who has died at the quite old age of 90 years old. Gustav VI Adolf has been on the throne since 1950, when he took over from his own dad, Gustav V. He's played the role of a constitutional monarch in a modern democratic welfare state very well, and never meddling in politics or expressing any opinions that could be seen as political, but at the same time remaining a figurehead for the nation.
He also, which is very cool, has a keen interest in archaeology. And in fact, he was quite an accomplished amateur archaeologist, going on several digs throughout his life. In general, he's seen as a bit of an academic king, and was made an honorary doctor both of the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden and honorary member of the British Academy.
Speaking of Britain, he was a bit of an Anglophile. Both his wives were British. He sadly lost his first wife, Princess Margareta, whom he had 5 children with, in 1920, when they were both only in their 40s. He then remarried Louise Mountbatten a few years later, who would then become Queen Louise when he took over the throne. The two grew old together as king and queen, and were often quite sweetly referred to by the public and the press as det gamla paret på Stockholms slott. The old couple at Stockholm Castle. In fact, my parents, who remember Gustav VI Adolf being king, they still refer to him as Gamle Kungen, the old king, which I think is quite funny because now our current king is also getting a bit old. He's just turned 78, so maybe he's Gamle Kungen now.
Yeah. Now the old king is dead, the crown actually skips a generation, because in 1947, the oldest son to Carl VI Adolf, Crown Prince Gustav Adolf, yeah, the same name as his dad, as we know from history, they didn't vary their names too much, and this is definitely the case now too. Well, the Crown Prince died in a plane crash in Copenhagen just a few months after the current king, Carl Gustav, was born. So that made the current king, Carl Gustav, the Crown Prince and heir to the throne when he was just a couple of months old. And a few days after the death of his grandfather then, Carl Gustaf is officially sworn in, becoming king with the regnal number of 16. And because that's all there is really, there isn't a full-blown ceremony, there's no coronation, and so it's not really that big a deal. He does walk into the palace and has to read out like the royal oath, and he gives his royal motto that he's going to be reigning with, and it looks very formal. Like, it's more formal than, for example, the Danish sort of coronation. It wasn't a coronation, but the Danish accession that happened very recently in Denmark. It's a bit more formal than that, but it's certainly absolutely nothing compared to the British royal family.
No, and there's no coronation. The last time we had a coronation in Sweden was when Oscar II was crowned king back in 1873. We've kept our monarchy comparatively small scale in modern times. Some would argue that that's why we still have them, because it's less extravagant and over the top than in some other countries, which also meant that people didn't have any cause to be annoyed with the monarchy to the same extent. In fact, it took just a few years for almost all ceremonial power to be removed from the new king. By 1975, he stopped being the formal head of the armed forces, for example, but that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, because immediately after the death of the king is announced, the prime minister needs to address the nation. So thanks to this little bit of a warning he got, he's already made it to the TV studio in Gothenburg, and he has a speech prepared. Because since the king has been in hospital for a few weeks, and he was 90 years old, it's not entirely unexpected that he might die at some point, so Olaf Palme has a brief speech prepared. But one thing that Olaf Palme doesn't have prepared are suitable clothes to address the nation in, because he's been on the campaign trail, and he's been dressing modern and all cheerful people because he's a social democrat. He's one of the people. And in 1973, that meant dressing colourfully.
Yeah, Palme's colourful jacket and lack of a tie is not something to address the nation in when the king has just died. Even for a nominally Republican social democrat like Palme. So they quickly make their way to the costume department of the TV studio to see if they can find something a bit more somber and suitable for him to wear. At the time, a popular sitcom called Albert and Herbert was filmed in the studios in Gothenburg, and the character of Herbert has a dark suit, white shirt and black tie that fit the Prime Minister. So they borrowed that. Never mind what trousers he wears, he's gonna be sitting down in the TV studio anyway.
And now this sitcom, Albert and Herbert, that's a Swedish version of a popular British sitcom from the 60s called Steptoe and Son. And I think there was an American version called Stanford and Son. And some of our British and American listeners might recognise either one of those two shows and find it quite funny that the Prime Minister of Sweden is addressing the nation on the death of the king wearing Harold Steptoe or Lament Stanford in the US their clothes. This was a sitcom about a father and son who are rag and bone men, or junkyard dealers, I guess you might say, in America, as in they sold scrap and junk and second-hand goods. And in the series, they're portrayed as living in quite poor and filthy conditions and wearing clothes that are appropriate to that.
Yeah, it's quite sort of filthy and poor and ragged in general. You know, I mean, of all the TV series they could have borrowed clothes from, it's quite bizarre that they did it from that one. Still, it seems to have gone off without a hitch. The Prime Minister looked suitably smart to address the nation. I guess a black jacket, even if a bit worn, is still more suitable than a super colourful 1970s one for announcing the death of a king.
The Prime Minister would likely not have had too much time to worry about it either way, because the very next day he's going to find out the results of the election. Because, yeah, the king has died the day before the general election, which is insane. Could you imagine if this happened in the UK, the amount of chaos that there would have been if the king or queen had died just hours before the general election? It would have been like a tsunami of chaos.
Well, not just that. So in the space of these 3 weeks, they've had the biggest bank robbery and hostage taking in the country's history, with all of that, the failings of the police and so on. And then the king has died, and now there's a general election. Yeah, I couldn't imagine that happening in the UK either. But in Sweden in 1973, they stick to the plan and muddle through. Maybe it would have been even more difficult to just postpone the election. I guess everything was set up and ready to go. Or they just saw no need to postpone it. Either way, the election goes ahead and it delivers a hung parliament.
Meaning that when the results are counted, the seats in the parliament are split exactly 50-50 between the right-wing and the left-wing parties. The Social Democrats and the Communists together get 175 seats, and the Moderates, the Liberals and the Centre Party also get 175 seats.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an issue that they should have foreseen, the fact that parliament at the time could be split exactly 50-50. There were in total 350 seats, meaning that each side could get 175 votes. Nonetheless, there isn't a re-election or anything, because in the end it's clear that the Social Democrats have gotten 0.1% more of the total voting share. So based on that, they form government and Olof Palme wins another term as Prime Minister. But for the next 3 years, until the next general election, some votes in Parliament do end up being split exactly 175 against 175, leading to a need to draw straws to decide the vote. Which is why the 1973 to 1976 Parliament is sometimes known as Lotteririksdagen, the Lottery Parliament. So that's very not democratic at all, really.
It's utterly bonkers. Or perhaps the ultimate form of democracy. We'll leave that for a political science podcast to discuss, I guess. Because for now, Sweden is just chugging along with a new king, a new parliament, and a new way of making its decisions, all in the background and aftermath of a spectacular bank robbery and hostage situation. And it's all at the end of three incredibly intense weeks in August and September of 1973.
You might be glad to hear that Sweden has sorted out the whole equally divided parliament. They did that soon after it happened in 1973, and they solved it by simply removing one seat. So parliament now has 349 seats, which means it can't be equally split 50-50.
But isn't the speaker chosen from the parliament?
It is, yeah.
So then it would go down, and then it would be equal again.
No, the speaker's chair isn't vacant.
They elect someone to replace the speaker
exactly.
In the parliament. That is weird. Anyway, good we don't have to worry about these straw-making decisions. And there are, of course, loads more we could have said about this year and about this time period, and we will eventually get there in a long way off in the regular timeline.
Yeah, we'll get there in another couple of hundred episodes' time, and then we can talk more about 1973.
And one final story about 1973 that we thought we'd mention before we end, because it's both about football and women's history.
Cool! Two of our favourite things.
Unfortunately, I couldn't find exactly which day, just that it was a Sunday in September, but that was when the first final of the Swedish Championships in women's football was played, and Öxnabäck beat Rättvik 3-0.
I'd say of all the things that happened, that's probably the most important thing, especially when you look at how much things have changed. And I think most of us agree have improved in women's sports since then. When the Öxnabäck players were interviewed about their first win on TV 50 years later, they talked about how back then they made their own kit. Initially, there were so few other women's teams to play against that they had to play against boys' teams. And even the local priest, he was so against women's football that he didn't give the younger players time off from their confirmation studies to go and play.
But luckily, the young players in Öxnabäck had a strong supporter in one of their teachers who rang the priest on their behalf and made them give the time off that they needed to play the championship finals.
Yeah, good on that teacher. And as a woman who enjoys playing sport, I look back in gratitude to those trailblazer women who carved out our place in sports and fought for our right to play on the same terms as men.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to end this episode. We'll come back to the 1970s at some point, but next time we're back to the 1520s, and we'll see how Sweden moves on with King Gustav Vasa at the helm, not a Carl Gustav or a Gustav Adolf.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe what 1973 and 1523 have in common. Both years had kings with the name Gustav.
They did indeed. And so thank you for listening. This has been great fun to have everybody along with us on this long journey we've been on through Swedish history. So thank you for being here for this anniversary episode 2. And we hope you stay with us for, hundreds of episodes more to come, which is a bit frightening to say.
As always, don't forget to follow us on social media. Visit our website, aflatpackhistoryofsweden.com. And if you want to send us an email, you can do so on flatpackhistorysweden@gmail.com. But for now, see you in 2 weeks' time.
Bye-bye.
Hej då.